Yeah, they smashed a record.
I know they did. Maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah.
At some point. They must have, I mean, 5 days? Was that it? More than that?
Nearly 5 days. And the thing with the record is that you can be the most prepared crew in the world, but if you're not lucky with the weather. So you can make your own luck.
Yeah.
Some of it is, and they've had quite a benevolent start, but they did everything they were told from day one. They worked hard. They knew what they wanted and they went for it. So it was very good. They were a great crew to work with. One of the things after the row, we inspect their boats to make sure that no trash has been thrown overside. So we'll count all their food packages.
Oh, this is good. You got to say all this.
And we'll...
Everybody wants to know.
We check all their safety kit, all that kind of stuff.
You can start whenever you want.
Okay. Welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. And we have a special guest today. But before we start, we want to go over why we started this show. And that is to bring more awareness to water safety. We have a 2025 water safety plan for Hawaii, which brought the following statistics up front. Hawaii has the second highest drowning rate in the country. Drowning is the major way that children 1 to 15 die in Hawaii. Our visitors, obviously, are a huge portion of drownings. 90% of those drownings are from snorkeling. With that said, we'd like to introduce our special guest. Ian Couch is a water safety officer for the world's toughest row. And since we've been talking to national experts, local experts, state experts. But today we have somebody who's doing a job right here because the world's toughest row has come back to Hanalei for the second time. We're excited. We had one boat come in called Swiss Raw, who set a world record. So we have Ian here to talk about everything, how he got involved, what this race constitutes in terms of being ready to race, and how that affects water safety. He's been with the Atlantic Campaign since 2012, has rowed since, you told me, 2009?
2007 was my first one.
Okay.
And then 2009, 2010.
And you've done rows in the Atlantic and Indian Ocean?
Correct, yes.
And set some world records. And according to Nikki, you have coached 1,000 teams in your profession as being the ocean water safety expert for the world's toughest row. So if we're going to learn anything about water safety, I think it's from you, Ian. So thank you so much for taking your time because you've got boats coming in and you need your phone in front of you for communication. Let's start with you telling us about you and how you got involved.
Way, way back when, I was watching a TV program back in the UK with a friend. And it was a documentary about two guys, an Olympic athlete and a celebrity, who rode the Atlantic as a race. I watched the film and they were crying and they were disorganized. And I looked and thought, can it really be that bad? I started to sort of get more and more interested. And I went and spoke to the organizer of the event at the time. And I said, I'd like to row. And he said, well, I'm putting together a crew to try and break some records. Would you like to apply? I applied, got the position on the crew. And sure enough, we went and had this amazing row. It was life-changing for me, without trying to sound a cliche. It was everything an adventure could be. It was physical. It was mental. It was very emotional. It was technical. You had the real chance that you could fail as well. Otherwise, it was just going to be uncomfortable exercise. I'd been in the army at that stage for about 16 years and quite a good career. And I stepped off the boat and I handed my resignation in because this was something special. After that, I carried on being involved with extreme sports and polar stuff and desert stuff. But it was the ocean that really got me. And more people climb Everest in a year than have ever rowed across an ocean, especially here on the Pacific now. It's something truly special and it's quite humbling and it strips away everything that isn't important. And so you come away thinking, I know what's important to me. It's very honest because you can tell social media, you can tell friends and family what it is you're going to do. But when you step off and look at yourself in a mirror at the end, you know exactly how you behaved, where you rose to the challenge and where you perhaps weren't who you hoped you were going to be. So it's an incredibly powerful thing. And in 2013, when the first race happened under the current format, Carsten, the race owner, asked me if I'd like to come on board. And so I said, yes, as long as I don't have to do anything to do with media. Here I am, and finances, I'd be happy. I just want to do the operational side of things, the training, looking after rows. And since then, I've been very fortunate enough to be part of growing the race and improving the success rate, the lessons learned. Every year we learn something new and it's constantly growing. Our success rate within the race since then is 97% success rate. Outside the race, it's about 60%. And it's not that we make it easy. We're just learning lessons and we look after the rowers and we make sure that they meet standards and that they appreciate that the ocean is an incredibly powerful and unforgiving environment to be in. The problem is sometimes people overestimate themselves and underestimate the ocean. And our job is to take that the other way around.
Well, we want to hear more because here in Hawaii, we have a lot of elite athletes. We have outrigger paddlers, surfers, canoe sailors, and they're out in the ocean doing races that maybe are 100 miles. I've done ones that have been 30 miles. So we have no understanding of what you're talking about. And so anything you can tell us about how you prepare people to be safe would be great for our listeners.
I think it starts with understanding, really. And however much you tell someone what it's going to be like, you can never fully convey just what being exposed in the ocean for that length of time does. We're talking 30 days if you're fast, but sometimes on the Atlantic we have people there that are 100 days, and that's 100 days of rowing for 2 hours, having perhaps 90 minutes sleep if you're lucky, day in, day out, until you get off the other end. The only way you get to the finish is you keep rowing. There's no stepping off the boat, there's no hoping it's going to go away. Every problem has to be faced and dealt with, which is tremendously empowering because you don't have a choice. That absence of choice means that you become quite powerful in what you can do. And it's a life-changing experience for a lot of people. And that's a huge privilege of the job, is seeing the people that sign up thinking they know what it's about. And when they step off here on the beach and they walk up onto the shores of Kauai in Hanalei Bay, you can see it's changed everything. That's a great thing. But it's all about preparation. You get the row that you train for, not the row you hope for. And so we have an 18-month to 2-year process, and it covers everything that we've ever encountered that could go wrong and the things that we imagine that could go wrong. And so we try and give them the power to train and prepare and prepare and prepare and prepare. And there's a quote that is, don't train until you get it right, train until you can't get it wrong. Because when you're out there and you're so tired and your decision-making goes and you look for easy options, but we want the things to happen just automatically because it's so ingrained. And that's part of keeping people safe.
So what is the procedure? Let's say I saw that you're asking people to join to become part of the world's toughest row. What happens? You get people, and then how do we train? It's 18 months to 2 years.
You can do it less than 18 months to 2 years, but that's a good run-in time. Because people have real life. They have jobs and families and the other things. And you could buy a boat and go out and hope, but it's the ocean. That's foolish at best. So from the time you sign up, we'll start communicating with you and we'll give you initially a training log, and it tells you how many hours as a minimum you have to row, and you have to produce evidence that you've done that. We need to see your tracks and your speeds and where you've gone and the conditions. Within that, we'll need to see that you've done your self-recovery, your man overboard drills, your power anchor drills, basically everything you can envisage. You have to have done it multiple times by day and by night so that you are completely ready, so that when you're tired and fatigued and scared, you can still do these skills. So you do the hours, then you have to have some key qualifications. You need to have a first aid at sea course, a sea survival course, a radio license, essential seamanship and navigation course, this fundamental knowledge which applies to everyone across anything doing at sea, and then is very much the ocean specific stuff. And then we run training package on top of that, which is very detailed about living life on an ocean rowing boat, being safe. And that's covering the boat, your physical health, your mental health, your team dynamics, nutrition, your kit and equipment. We stipulate everything you need to have, so all the equipment you need, all the safety measures, how many calories you need to take per person depending on your weight for how many days. It's stuff that's evolved over time, and we see it happen and trial and error to make sure that mistakes aren't repeated. Because it's good to learn from your own mistakes, but it's even better to learn from other people's. So that's where we are now. It's that constant evolving just to make sure that it's more than just survival exercise. You can find pleasure out there.
This incident debriefing, do you have those kinds of things? Is that what goes into your training and learning more about what you're doing?
We'll have a safety team and headquarters debrief. We will talk to the crews in detail. Communication is one of the greatest things that we have, really, to keep people safe, because they will have on board two emergency tracking beacons, personal tracking beacons. The boat is tracked. They have 3 satellite telephones. I will speak to them every other day. They can call us 24/7. So any little issue, we like to identify early before it becomes a significant issue. But then if anything does happen, we do a post-row debrief, and then those lessons get taken forward into our rules, into our training guidance and our terms and conditions to make sure things shouldn't be repeated. But there's always a human factor. There's always be that, honestly, it tends to be the younger guy who's flexing a little bit and they're a little bit too much ego and those sort of things happen. You hear them, they're going to, we're going to conquer the ocean. And the moment you hear it, you go, oh, you're not going to conquer anything apart from yourself because the ocean doesn't care. And it's humility and just rehearsing and finding pleasure in it as well. And that's a huge part of the safety, because whether you're miserable or whether you're happy, the distance you have to row is exactly the same. So it's a pleasure to be out there on the water. You've done a lot to get there. Perhaps your friends and families and sponsors have done a lot to help you. You almost owe it to yourself and them to enjoy it. Sometimes we jokingly call it type two fun. So you look at it in retrospect and think, yeah, that was okay. But at the time, it's pretty miserable. Everyone's signing up for something called the world's toughest row. And no one's story ever starts, oh, you remember that day that nothing ever happened. It's what it gives you. It's the challenges you overcome that make this so special. And we jokingly say it's a race, but actually it's a lifestyle choice. You can be the fittest athlete if doing ultra marathons or whatever, but actually this is 30, 40, 50 days. It's how you live, how you conduct yourself as a human being, how you interact with the people around you. These are the things that really give the row its character.
What about their diet? I read something that the Swiss Raw had burned like 50,000 calories per week during their race.
Easily 50,000 calories. 100 kilo guy, so what's that, 220 pounds, you will be required to take 6,000 calories a day. We've done a lot of research. We had a very good project done testing on the rowers to find out whether you're young, old, male, female. And this figure is basically the bedrock of that. So everyone has to take this amount of food. Eating becomes a job. It's putting fuel in your engine because you might be seasick or you might just be tired and fatigued. You might just not like that food that day. But yes, 6,000 calories for a 220-pound man every day, and you'll still lose weight because even if you ate 10,000 calories a day, your body just won't be able to consume it and metabolize it with the physical energy, the nervous energy. The process of being out there isn't, you never recover when you're at sea. All you're doing is your very best to delay your physical breakdown. So eating is part of it. You have your calories today. The crews that tend to do well are almost like competitive eaters. They can get 1,000 calories down themselves in 30 seconds. Then they can go to sleep and they can get back fed, rested, and get on the oars.
So before we go into more detail about the boat, where they sleep, how they eat, where all that goes, those logistics, the race was started and I see that they all have sponsors. Was that how that all worked out?
All the crews have individual sponsors, people they know, businesses. Every crew raises money for charity. Last year alone, we had an American crew that raised over $40 million, just one crew, for the Michael J. Fox Parkinson Foundation. And so since the race has started on both oceans, millions and millions of dollars have been raised for a variety of charities. Because the fleet is so diverse, our youngest rower is 17 we've had. Our oldest is in their mid-70s. They come from all over the world. They all have personal connections with charities. It's a huge thing, and it's very personal for a lot of the people.
That's really interesting. And so the mission of World's Toughest Row is?
The mission is to allow as many people to cross an ocean rowing boat, as safely as possible, and hopefully with as much enjoyment as possible.
And so far, that's happened.
We've had a 97% success rate, because things will happen, a boat will happen, there'll be a crew issue. We've had one death at sea since we started, and that was a medical issue rather than a safety issue. If you look at the cross-section of the population of anyone doing anything, sometimes that just happens. It was a horrible tragedy, it was a horrible thing for the family, it was a horrible thing for the crew. But unfortunately, these things happen. It's how it's dealt with is important, and any lessons we learn from it.
Okay, before we start on this boat, this is the second time you've crossed the Pacific.
It's actually our third.
Our third year now. So tell me how that is compared to the Atlantic.
It's really interesting because all the rowers go, which one's harder? And the hardest ocean is the one you rowed last. Because we've had people that rowed the Atlantic and they came and rowed this, went, that was so hard. That was way harder. Then they go back and row the Atlantic and go, no, actually the Atlantic's way harder. Every row is different. The weather's different each year. Perhaps your training's been different. Your crew might be different. There are fundamental challenges which are the same on all of them. You've got to stay safe. You are clipped to that boat. You've got to eat. You've got to maintain skin hygiene and look after your body. You've got to get on with your crew. You've got to navigate. And you've got to haul this boat, best part of 3,000 miles. So all those challenges are the same.
Are the races all the same distance or not?
This one's slightly shorter.
Oh,
The Atlantic is 3,000 miles. This is sort of more like 2006, 2007. But again, that will vary depending on the routes that crews can take. The fundamental difference here is that we start from mainland America and the coastal waters are cold because everything's coming down from the north, tends to be onshore, and it's really hard. the first part of any row is always difficult. Day one is okay because you've got a bit of adrenaline. By day three, it's the worst thing you've ever done because you're seasick and you're sore and you're tired and you have all the doubts of whether I can do this for another 30 days. And then by day five, you start to get into a groove. And by day seven, your brain says to your body, OK, so we're doing this then, are we? And the pain becomes a little bit more just background noise. You're so tired, you start to sleep properly. The seasickness passes, you start to eat. And by that stage, you get into your groove. Here on the Pacific, that first week is so much harder because you have the cold weather, constant wind coming in from the sea. So it's harder rowing. But the flip side is if it goes wrong, we don't like it, you can turn around and you can row back down. Whereas on the Atlantic, once you start, there's no coming back and you have to go.
And where do you start in the Atlantic?
We start on a small island called La Gomera, which is part of the Canary Isles, so it's the north coast of Africa. And we finish in Antigua.
How long is this boat?
29 feet, approximately. They vary slightly because we have some boats only have two people, some with three, some with four, some with five. And on the Atlantic, we have solos, just on boats on their own.
How does everyone sleep? Where do you store all the food? How does that all work?
So the boats are amazing things. I think, honestly, they're probably the safest thing you can be at sea on. You could take a chainsaw and cut it in half and you've just got two really bad boats. But it won't sink. It's completely compartmentalized. If you keep the hatches shut, it self-rights really aggressively because they do capsize. And we stipulate you have backups to all your systems, normally multiple backups. So it's scary because you're no more than a few inches off the water and there are big waves that come over and you will capsize. And at night, it's completely dark and it's like being blindfolded on a roller coaster and you're throwing yourself down waves. The longer you're out there, the more faith you have in your boat. The waves you get on day one, you go, this is a bit big and a bit scary. And by 20, you want bigger waves that are faster. And so you're surfing and you're getting 15 or 20 knots mid-ocean surfing. And everything is stored under deck. There's lots of individual compartments. You'll never get a hull breach. That means everything floods. You have a forward and aft cabin. The forward cabin is a little bit larger. There's no electronics in it. It's jokingly called a spa or the luxury hotel accommodation. The other end of the boat is where the skipper tends to sleep. And that's got the auto tillers in it, all the electronics, the chart plotters, the radios. It's a phenomenally unpleasant place to sleep, actually, both of them. It's hot, it's damp. You have to keep that cabins shut, so stifling heat.
How long do they sleep for?
It varies, but most people do 2 hours rowing, 2 hours resting. And in that resting, it'll be the first thing you do will be do any job that needs to be done on the boat. So cleaning solar panels, fixing anything, desalinating water, making food. Then perhaps you'll go to sleep. So if you're lucky, you'll get 90 minutes. Sometimes you won't get any. So you have 30, 40, 50 days of power naps, basically.
How do you train for that?
You can't really. You can't prepare yourself fully because we want everyone to start fully rested. You can't store sleep up. If you make sure that you know your boat, you know your equipment, you've rehearsed all these things, that's the best thing you can do because then you don't have to think about it. And the safety things just happen.
So does everybody have the same boat? Or is
there
the
are
boat
two in- companies that build boats. Mm-hmm. They all have to meet the same safety standards. And it's just a matter of choice then for people. But majority of the boats are built by one company and they are all similar, just varies in size.
So Swiss Raw, tell me some more. How did they break that record?
Well, this is actually the second time they rode with us. They rode on the Atlantic with us before. They want to come and set a record. We get a lot of people go, we're going to win the race and we're going to set a record. And so you ask them, well, what are you going to do differently? Because what everyone does now is what the record breakers were doing 3-4 years ago. So what are you going to do to be different? And you have to prepare to make more sacrifices. You have to train more. You have to train harder. You have to row harder. You have to communicate home less. Just sacrifice more. And your goal must be to win. And then you have a secondary goal and a tertiary goal. So there's always things that you can achieve. And the guys were just really good. They spoke to us a lot and they brought their experience from the Atlantic when they were a great crew to deal with out there as well. They knew what they had to do. And they just went and did it. No fuss, no questions. They did a great job. They won the race. They set a record. But that might not be what everyone wants to do. Some people want to row an ocean and they want to stop sometimes and they want to look at the stars. Or if there are dolphins, they want to stop and they want to watch the dolphins. We would say one is not any better than the other. It depends what it is that you want to get out of it. And the Swiss guys, they wanted to row, they committed to the win. They got what they worked for.
And so there's nobody out there with them. People ask me that question.
You could have, so the Swiss guys arrived over a week ago.
Right.
The next boat's coming in now. The last boat's probably on the 14th. You're going to have over 1,000 miles between crews. Unless you have a support boat sitting next to every boat, it's almost pointless. So we rely on their training to keep them safe, to communication with us to keep them safe and constant monitoring. We won't let them start if they are not up to the standard and we don't think they're safe. There was a crew this year in Monterey. I stopped going because the ocean will still be there next year. But if they'd gone, that could have had disastrous consequences. And it's not just you as a rower that has a consequence. It's the people that might have to come and rescue you. And it's your family and your friends and the impact that has. So
that's a really good question. How did you decide they weren't ready for the row?
I think I've now looked after probably 2/3 of everyone that's ever rowed an ocean. There are the black and white factors of, yes, you've done your hours, you know your skills. We check the boats before we let them get to the start. We check them again at the start. And part of that is a conversation we have with the rowers. And this crew couldn't answer some of the fundamentals. And
like what?
Go and get me this certain piece of equipment.
I see.
And they bought the wrong piece of equipment. But actually, more fundamentally than that, this particular crew, there was a huge disparity with their goals, their aims, how they got on with each other. There was hostility before they even started. You don't have to be friends, but you have to be able to work together. This would have been pretty much a disaster for them. Certainly the skipper of the boat, when we told him, went, yeah, I agree, that's the right decision.
Who decides who the skipper is?
The crews.
And that's, what is that job?
It's a very small team. So actually, there's no skipper sort of cracking a whip and beating a drum. It's more the person that gathers the ideas, discusses it with the crew, and then says, right, if there's disagreement, this is how we're going to do it. The skipper is the person that says, yes, we're safe to leave port. I can say, yes, you're safe to leave for the race. But if you're not happy, you don't go. You can't get out there a week and go, oh, we weren't ready, you shouldn't have sent us. To us, you met our standards. If you don't feel you're ready, you don't go. If there was to be a rescue at sea, I would be coordinating, or my colleague would be coordinating with the rescue authorities. But the final part would be when the boat comes along, it's the skipper that's going to be talking to the rescuing vessel.
How would you organise a rescue at sea?
The first thing normally would be one of the emergency beacons gets triggered. And then we will make contact with the crew. And we've got a number of ways to do that. We'll speak to the crew and find out the nature of the emergency. If they need to be evacuated, that beacon will have also been picked up by the Coast Guard or the Marine Rescue Coordination Centres. They then call us. And so we have a three-way conversation between us, the crew, and the Coordination Centre or Coast Guard. The decision will be made what happens next. And same as any other vessel at sea, the Coast Guard will divert the nearest vessel to go to their aid. And that might be a luxury yacht, it might be a sailing boat, it might be a cargo vessel, and they will come and offer aid.
Have you ever had to have any boat rescued?
Yeah, certainly. On the Atlantic over the years, we've done it a few times. It's a process that's unpleasant, but it works, and that's the key thing. You know, rescue is never an easy option. It's not
because lose the boat?
Yeah. It's rescuing life, it's not saving property. In the past, early on sometimes, we might be able to go out and recover the boat, but if it's a true rescue, it's just about getting the people off.
How long did that take?
On the Atlantic, from beacon to boat being with you can be less than 8 hours. It can be as long as 20. It depends on the conditions, how easy it is to find you. But it's a pretty rapid process. And then once you're on board that rescuing vessel, you go to wherever that vessel's going to. So you might be rowing to Kauai, but next thing you know, you're in Australia or you're somewhere else. And our responsibility then is with the crew. We talk to the vessel, we'll talk to the crew, their family. We'll go out and meet them wherever they get to the other side, make sure that they've got onward transport. We don't just let them go.
This is a big job you have, Ian.
It is phenomenally rewarding. To be part of everyone's journeys is absolutely phenomenal. When you're out there on this little boat and you can stretch your arms out and you can reach either side and you're inches over the water and you've got waves that are 30 feet coming down and you're surfing at 15 knots, or it's completely calm and it's flat and it's like a mirror, or there's not a light in the sky and it's black, or you see every star more than you ever imagine. It's just a massive privilege. And not everyone gets it, but for those that do, then that's my job. It's brilliant.
I would say a lot of people in the sport that I do, outrigger paddling, would say exactly those things.
And in fact, it's hard. No one wants it to be easy. You know, that's the thing. You want to come off and go, I earned that. I earned those 3,000 miles. My blisters are my badges there.
So we're talking about a water safety plan for Hawaii. Yeah. And we're also talking about how we inform more people to make them more aware of the ocean and how to be safer in the ocean. Do you have any thoughts about that for just our listeners and visitors?
I think the hardest thing is to let people understand just what the ocean is, how it can be. Especially if you come to somewhere as beautiful as this, you see it's tranquil, it's a paradise. People may have saved all year or for many years to come here. They want to be in the water, they see it. I would say if you're looking at the water on a training rope and you go, oh, I'm not sure today whether that's safe or not, you've already got your answer. Always take the cautious side. You don't do stuff in the water on your own. You always make sure that you've got someone there with you, and you just stay within your limits. And I know I'm talking about a sport where people are pushing their limits, but there's a point between being brave and adventurous and being foolhardy, and it's hard to make sure that you get that right. So I think it's respect for the ocean. Don't overestimate your own abilities. Just check where you're going in the water. You've got to check for local conditions. Check what could change. Look for the rips. Look for the tides. All that kind of stuff. It's the same as when we're talking to the guys going out on the boats and the training rows. The most dangerous part, actually, isn't when you're mid-Pacific. It's when you're near the coast. Because when you're 10 miles at sea, it doesn't matter if you go a mile that way or a mile that way. You're not hitting anything. The currents are very different. You're there at shore, and the currents are whipping around the rocks. They're whipping up and down the shoreline. It's far more aggressive. And you know, as a swimmer in the water, you're in far more danger there. When the guys go off mid-ocean, they're tied to the boat to clean the boat. Yes, they get taken slightly, but it's a very different feeling to when you're in the shore and getting taken off by a rip.
So they're tied to the boat and they're cleaning the boat?
We have a number of fundamental rules.
Okay.
The first one is you're always tied to the boat, always. You're in the cabin, you want to go on deck, you have a harness on, you open that cabin hatch, you reach out, you clip onto the deck, then you step out. Whether it's for 3 seconds or 3 hours, you get back in the cabin, and only when you're back in, you unclip. If you have to go over the side, you're clipped on and you have a safety line. So you can never be apart from that boat. I also helped the Coast Guard back in the UK with post-incident reports outside the race. And there was a young lad that got swept off a boat. He wasn't tied on. It wasn't within the race. It was independent. It was a big boat. There's 8 people on board. He got swept over the side. He wasn't tied on. He tried to grab the boat. He couldn't. Someone tried to grab him. They couldn't. They couldn't turn the boat. They couldn't stop the boat because of conditions. And they watched him for 45 minutes before he drowned, and they lost him. He was 21 years old. And it's that thing where so many accidents are avoidable. It's just fundamental that you're tied to the boat. In the same way, I think if you're going to the beach, it's fundamental you know what the currents are. That 2 minutes of education, that 30 seconds of making a decision will save everything. And I know that's difficult when you're tired or fatigued or you're excited, but it's just grounding yourself. And it's not to take away the enjoyment or the pleasure. You still have the pleasure, but without the risk.
Well, we're trying to do a water safety plan for our canoe club. Just basically, we have a morning group, an older group, and then a competitive group. But we're starting with the older group and the kids to actually have in place, like you've talked about, things that we need in the canoes, procedures we follow, incident debriefing, so we learn and improve on safety.
The greatest thing you have is knowledge. When I started doing this, you rode an ocean and it was such a horrible experience. No one ever really spoke about it. And there was never any lessons learned or anything passed forward. And I think that's what we've become very good at now. We analyse every race, every event, every incident. How can we make it better? And you have to hold your hands up sometimes to go, oh, we missed something there. We could have been better. So let's make sure as we go forward, we do it. You can't afford to have an ego with it. You've got to just do what's best for the people that are coming after you.
That makes total sense. And here we're just doing small things, but I think the small things need to be safe also.
Being on the coast is just as dangerous in many ways. When you're out there rowing an ocean, you're thinking about safety all the time. You've got this boat, which is phenomenally safe. You've got these equipment. We talk about safety, 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 safety all the time. We have a whole crisis ops document. So that's always in people's heads. I imagine if someone's going snorkeling here or going for a canoe, it's about the fun of the event. It's a different mindset when you go into it. And again, it's getting that balance between not putting people off by scaring them, but still just having the right things on board, having people know the procedures, basic life-saving skills, that sort of thing makes a huge difference.
Do you have any recommendations for me? Because that's exactly right. People that paddle, they don't want to be told what to do. They know how to be safe. But at the same time, we need those things in the canoes. We need things like PDF, personal flotation devices. We need ways to communicate in the canoe.
Yeah.
Not everybody's doing that.
I think even just basically a phone and a VHF radio in a waterproof case, it's not much money. It can stay with the boat. We have little emergency beacons that you can wear on a belt, a little PLB. It gives an emergency position straight away if someone's lost. A single throw line, or a short, not a full life jacket, but a small inflatable like safety tube, something that could be thrown to someone. If it makes 30 seconds or a minute's difference, that could be enough to help them get back to a boat or gather their breath and be calm enough to save themselves. So little things are huge. It doesn't need to be super expensive or take up much space. And knowledge is the other thing. I think people knowing how to do water rescue, how to do CPR, that sort of thing is important.
Right. We've been training people in the Canoe Club for CPR. And one of the issues we have here is we haven't had water safety education in the schools, and we're trying to get that back in the schools with a bill that kind of, you know, stopped for a while, paused, and that was disappointing. So we hope that it gets back in, because it used to be something that was very important in the schools.
Well, as you say, if the majority of the people that are being lost to drowning are children, to have that taught to them at a very early age, it then just becomes the social norm, isn't it? You expect it, everyone knows it, it's just what you do. But it takes a while to get into that position. But again, it goes back to like what we do with the rowers. You have to make it normal. So it's not, oh, I have to go and do this. It's just what happens. And if that's what just happens, people are safer naturally.
That's a really good point. Mike Tipton talked about it's International Drowning Prevention Day, July 25th. And he has got a campaign that's been accepted over in Australia and some other countries called Find Your Float. And he talks about the fact that if you can just stay calm and float, it could really make a difference.
Yeah. Something very similar in the UK, Float to Live, which is great. But again, it's we just say, just stay calm. That is so hard. We use the word just. It's so hard. When everything's gone horribly wrong, perhaps you've been capsized, you've been hurt, someone else has been hurt, there's a lot going on. To get your breathing under control is something that needs to be taught. People go, yeah, I can stay calm.
Do you teach that?
It's part of the sea survival course that they do. They get that sort of drowning prevention.
And can you tell me something about that, how you stay calm?
The whole psychology part of it, a lot of it has to go back to you trust your training. And we go back to that thing where I said, you've got to do it, not so you get it right, so you can't get it wrong. It's something that you have to keep thinking about, so it's present. If you're going out in the water all the time, it should almost be part of, right, I'm going out today. It takes you 2 minutes to go, what happens if something goes wrong? How am I going to cope with it? What's it going to feel like? One of the examples we use is our boats capsize sometimes. We try and get the crews to prepare for that. And we had a great crew. They rowed into here, actually. They set the female pair's record. A brilliant pair. They'd done the same on the Atlantic. And they phoned us up and said, we're sure we're going to capsize. We feel it, the conditions are such. Right, let's go through procedures. What are you going to do? How's it going to be like? And it's not just a really dry black and white, this is what it's going to be like. What's it going to feel like, sound like, smell like? What's it going to taste like? We call it emotional inoculation. And try and get as much of that fear done through your visualization. And then sure enough, a couple of hours later, they phoned us up and went, it happened, we capsized. We're so happy because everything worked for them. Because
emotional inoculation.
It's what they did. And it's the thing. You go through things as much as you can. And if you can practice it for real time, you practice it. But some things you just can't do. So you just have to do the visualization of it. And you do the breathing exercises and you calm yourself down. It might be that when that thing happens, the plan you have isn't the right plan. But you've already had a thought process. You're far less likely to freeze in shock if you've already started thinking about what you're going to do. So it's just building that awareness and try and make it routine before you go on the water.
Is any of that plan you could share with us? Any little bit that I could bring to the Canoe Club?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure I can. I'll put something down about that.
That would be great.
Yeah, of course.
We have a really large children's program, the biggest in Kauai, and that would be great.
I actually think in many ways the children would be far easier to do it with. You get to my age and older, perhaps you become slightly more stuck in your ways. And I've done this for years, I'm fine. Actually, it's the overconfidence. Like, we go back to that. It's the overconfidence that makes the problems. Everything's great until it isn't. And then all of a sudden, you've not gone through the process. And that's when the problems arise.
There was a quote you said, I tell them to be overprepared pessimists, not shocked optimists.
Yeah. Again, we tend to. This is after they've signed up for the race, clearly, not before they've signed up. But right. I said, I would rather some come along. And what we go through all the scenarios, everything we can realistically envisage goes wrong. And we talk about how to cope with it, how to deal with it. And it's better that you go and be this really well-prepared pessimist that's gone through all the problems, saying, oh, this could happen, than someone who's going to come on and go, it's going to be rainbows and dolphins and it's going to be great. And then that thing happens and bang, it's chaos. And you get that shock and you can't function. You just got to prepare for you prepare for the worst, you hope for the best.
So what are you doing now? Today it's almost 2 o'clock on Monday, and you have had one crew come in and the next one scheduled to come in tomorrow.
So tomorrow. So when the crew get, I'll be monitoring them. I've had a couple of non-urgent messages come through here now. We'll start monitoring their approach. And when they reach 20 miles out, they'll give me a call. And
then, what's an urgent message?
An urgent message will be a medical problem.
Oh,
or
okay.
Serious technical.
Okay.
The ones that come through now are just...
Where they are.
Just chat. At 20 miles, we'll talk through the procedures. We'll remind them everything that they need to do and guide them in. We'll talk about local conditions. We'll talk about the timings. We'll talk about having all the communications on. We'll go down. We'll set up the arrivals area for them. We have a media boat that will go out and meet them and guide them in over the last mile. We'll be right next to them. And it's just getting ready for that. Straight after this, I go down to Hanlow Pier and their families are there. And we do a brief for the families. So at the start, families and friends are invited to the start and we have a meeting without the rowers so we can tell them, the families, what it's going to be like. And then today they'll be here and we'll talk about where to be, where to stand, how the rowers will recover. The families are a huge part of this. They're going through all the anxiety without any of the pleasure. So we try and include them in it as well. And it makes it more supportive for everyone, because if the families are happy, the rowers are happy, we get less anxious calls. It just works.
So after this interview, you're going down to the pier?
Yeah.
When they get off the boat, when one of the Swiss Raw gentlemen came off, they were helping him walk around.
Yeah.
Is that because he had been on the boat for so many days?
You've not stood up for 30 days or however many days. So all the muscles and tendons that normally hold your hips, they are, have changed. And so that's difficult. But also your eye, brain, inner ear isn't working because you've been on this moving platform. So you can stand on solid land and it feels like it's moving. You get back on your boat and suddenly everything's good. So that can take 3-4 days really before that balance comes back to normal. But you'll still get a lot of lower back pain and hip pain. And you need to walk and gently recover and stretch and eat. But recovery is quick. The moment you get off the boat, your body's gone, thank you, we start to recover. You have the best shower of your life and then probably another best shower. You'll have proper food again. You don't have to wake up every 2 hours, though some people will sleep for 16 hours straight. Others will wake up every 90 minutes to go, oh my God, I've missed my watch. I need to start rowing again, or start trying to row their bed around or something like that. So it's quite hard to switch off. And we talk a little bit about the physical recovery and also the mental recovery and adapting back to normal life, because you can't expect someone to go from a very highly elevated sense of adrenaline for 30 days. Normal life again in the pace of 8 steps from the boat to the shore. There's that recovery part of it as well.
So you're part of the recovery too?
Yeah. It's part of what we talk about and what we try and help them with.
So how long does this go for you?
I still have people talk to me a year post-event. There was a great crew. They were doing really well, a great pair. And they would phone me up every day to check their course over ground. They had the course over ground. They were perfect, but they needed that reassurance. And we had this chat every day, just a few moments. And then some days I wouldn't get a call. And I thought, oh, almost feel disappointed. Why aren't they calling? And then they call later in the day. And then one of they contacted me a short while later and said, jokingly, oh, what's my course over ground? Absolutely brilliant relationship with these amazing people that you meet. And some of them talk longer. Some become friends for life. The process for everyone is different. It's nice to be able to be there for the people that need it.
Is there one specific event that you've been through that you'd with any of these rowers that you remember?
There are so many characters.
Yeah.
I mean, that last one, the course over ground check, for some reason, that one just stays with me because it was such an important thing to be part of. I was looking forward to their call, feeling part of something bigger with them. And that was really good. We have other crews that are, I mean, it's completely life-changing for so many people. They step off the boat and go, right, I'm going home. I'm going to change my house. I'm going to change my job.
Seriously?
Oh, 100%. Imagine now you've just been at sea for 60 days. You've overcome capsized technical problems. Someone on your crew has not worked hard and you had to work on those relationships and the phone's not ringing and you're not dealing with trivia, but you've overcome these amazing things. You step off the boat and went, I can do anything I want. And not everyone can row an ocean. It's not for everyone, but if you give yourself over to it, the more you commit, you get so much out of it.
I'm so glad you came on. Water safety is very important to us, and to hear from somebody who does it as a profession is really informative for everybody that listens to us and to the canoe clubs I'm part of, because we're struggling with what you're talking about. People who feel like they know so much and are comfortable about it, and others that don't want to know anything. But there are guidelines that we should be following, and we should be more vigilant, I think, about it.
I think you're absolutely right. And safety is one of the hardest things, but it's also the easiest thing. It's hard because people don't really want to think about it because it detracts from the pleasure of what they're going to do. And so that makes it hard. But actually, the things you need to do are really simple. And it's just trying to bring the two together to make sure that there's a balance. I think as soon as you can get it to become more cultural within an organisation, it just makes it a lot easier.
I appreciate that. That's what I'm working on. Thank you, Ian, for coming. And I'm going to watch for the next boat coming in.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to think about you every day as you're communicating. It's been very nice to meet you. And thank you for the hat. I really appreciate it. Well, I'll wear it.
Thank you for the book. Thank you for your hospitality. It's been lovely to talk about something that means so much to me. Appreciate it.